We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall never surrender until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of people.
In times of universal deceit, truth is the only rebellion left. On today's show, why platform matters. The difference between the Democrat and the GOP platform is huge, and it should determine your vote. And how Edmund Burke, a voice from nearly 300 years ago, speaks directly to our time and to our election. I'm Dr. Everett Piper, and this is The Rebellion. Welcome to today's Rebellion. The topic for today is platforms. I've said over and over again on the show that in the United States, a constitutional republic, we do not vote for a king, we vote for a covenant. It's about the Constitution. It's about the platform of the two competing parties. It's not about the person. So we don't elect a dictator. We don't elect a king. We don't really elect the person, even though the person does matter, I'll grant you that. But at the end of the day, that person has very limited power. So it's the ideas and it's the ideology, it's the principles and the values, it's the priorities of the two parties that matter. Who are they? What do they believe? What is their platform? And what are they telling you they stand for? That's what matters, and that's what we'll talk about today. We'll talk about the difference between the Democrat and the GOP platform. We'll talk about Edmund Burke of the mid-1700s and what he wrote and what he said and how it's prophetic for our time in his classic work, A Reflection on the French Revolution, Edmund Burke. Now, I know some of you are probably thinking, well, the GOP doesn't even have an official approved platform this year. I know there's a controversy right now, and I know there's a dispute within the committees that structure and craft the platform. But I think for the sake of today's discussion, and frankly for the sake of this election, that's a relatively insignificant issue in this context. There is a platform that still stands, and it's the 2016 platform of the GOP. Its values, its principles, its language stand in stark contrast to the Democrat platform, both of 2016 as well as the one they have today. So I'm going to focus on that. If you want to talk about the dispute within the GOP in terms of the final platform, we can do that at another time, but I really don't think that's of huge consequence to today's discussion. Before we get into the rest of the show, remember that you can call in or text in your questions or comments to 918-756-3646. You can also join the rebellion. You can subscribe at patreon.com/Dr. Everett Piper. That's patreon.com/DREVERETTPIPER. Join the rebellion. Subscribe to the rebellion. At given levels, you can get a free copy, autographed copy of my bestseller, Not a Daycare, The Devastating Consequences of Abandoning Truth, as well as, instead of that book, you can get Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas, which was my first book, A Defense of Classical Liberalism, Liberty, Freedom, the Human Dignity, that is the premise to all of that. You can also, if you subscribe at given levels to the Rebellion, become a member of our monthly dialogue and Q&A sessions, our jam sessions, if you will, on Zoom or Skype, where members that are at that level of subscription can engage in direct conversation with one another and sharpen one another as iron sharpens another, and I'll engage in that too. There's also a newsletter I'm very excited about where I share kind of inside scoop on things that I don't talk about directly on The Rebellion, such as recommended books and giving a briefing and quotes from those books, as well as other pertinent things that you should be watching online or on TV or on in various different social media venues, getting more information on what it means to be a classical conservative, a classical liberal person fighting for liberty and human freedom. Back to today's show. Why platforms matter and the difference between the two platforms. I'm going to summarize for you very briefly what I consider to be a bold, in-your-face distinction between the two platforms. between the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, and why I think it is unquestionably a given that if you believe in human liberty, if you believe in human dignity, if you believe in a constitutional republic, which we are, if you believe in the Constitution, if you believe in our seminal documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, if you believe in the values that led to the American Revolution and the establishment of the United States in the first place, a nation that is comprised of united sovereign states, and with unalienable rights and self-evident truths serving as the foundation for human dignity and human freedom of all people. If you believe in those things, then I don't think you have any choice but to acknowledge that the Republican Party is the only party left that has a viable chance of winning. I'm not disparaging other minor parties, and perhaps there will be a day when I'll eat crow and one of these parties will have enough clout to actually have a chance of victory. But right now, I think we all just must agree that no party that exists within the American political system right now has any chance in the world of gaining the presidency or gaining any power in Congress, in the House or in the Senate, other than the two parties. So the Constitutional Party and the Conservative Party and these other parties, libertarians and whatnot. Yes, I understand the value of a pluralistic and a multiple party system, but frankly, in the United States, pragmatically, we just don't have that right now. So I think you have to decide whether or not you're going to cast a vote for a Democrat or Republican, because if you cast your vote for somebody else, you're really casting your vote in protest as opposed to any quantitative potential of victory. And right now, you've got perhaps even the choice between the lesser of two evils. I'll even acknowledge that. But I think that one party is the personification of evil. The butchery of children, the degradation of women, misogyny, the division and the divisiveness of the Democratic Party, the anger, the vitriol, the rage, the lawlessness, the sacrifice of human dignity for personal power. To me, that's the Democrat Party. Whereas the Republican Party, far from perfect, and I've said before, I don't think Trump is anywhere close to perfect, but there's a difference between the two parties. So let's get to that. Here is what the Democrat platform preamble actually says. So the first few sentences of their platform says this: America is an idea. America is an idea. Americans believe that diversity is our greatest strength, that protest is among our highest forms of patriotism. They go on to say that the bill has come due on the Trump administration's hollowing out of public institutions, the gross corruption and abuses of power, the dereliction of duty, the emptiness of the Republican Party's America First foreign policy. America stands alone now. We are not liked or admired by other nations. The Republican Party under President Trump has made America small. Democrats will fight to repair the soul of the nation, to unite and to heal, forge a stronger, brighter, and more equitable future. We must right the wrongs of our democracy, redress the systematic injustices, reinvent our institutions at home. Democrats will forge a new social contract, ensure equal pay for women, guaranteed health care. Democrats will root out structural and systematic racism. We believe Black Lives Matter. We will give hate no safe harbor. We'll protect and promote equal rights for LGBTQ+ people. Taking on the climate crisis, we will not deny science. We will rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and go further, building a clean energy economy. We believe in the universal early childhood education, a more inclusive and resilient society. Democrats believe in the American idea. This is my abbreviation of the preamble. I'm going to go back and start out with the very first thing they said. America is an idea. Now, you may not find that to be objectionable. You may say, oh yeah, okay. But that's a terrible premise. America is not an idea. America is not an abstract theory. America is not a thought or a feeling. America is a fact. We are a real country, a real land, with real borders and real laws and a real constitution and real founding fathers with real values and real virtues and real ideas. America is not an idea. America is a nation. One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. America is an idea. You don't pledge allegiance to the idea of America. You pledge allegiance to the reality of America. This is a postmodern screed from the beginning. You need to understand the power in that statement, that if they can dumb down America to nothing but a fluid idea, they've basically done to America exactly what they've done to the human being, to sexuality, for example. If you can dumb down the human being to nothing but a subjective idea, fluid sexuality, to nothing but your passions, your proclivities, your desires, your ambitions. If you can dumb down anything to the abstract ideas that move with time and move with emotions, then it isn't an objective fact any longer. It's nothing but what the people in power tell you it is. It's their ideology. America is not just an idea. America is a fact. That is a critical statement to start with. I could pick through the other things that I pointed out, the systematic racism and science deniers and all that crap, but I don't have time to do with that. Let's deal with that. Let's just stop with the fact that their very premise, the first thing out of their mouth, is their claim that America is an abstract, a feeling. It's just a thought. It's an idea. And therefore, it can change with the wind. It can change as the people in power, as the majority decides it should change. Now, let's contrast that with the standing Republican Party platform. They start out by saying, "We, the Republican Party, reaffirm the principles that unite us in common purpose. We believe in American exceptionalism. We believe in the United States of America, and that it is unlike any other nation on earth. We believe America is exceptional because of our historic role. We affirm, as did the Declaration of Independence, that all are created equal, endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We believe in the Constitution. We believe the Constitution is our enduring covenant. We believe in limited government, separation of powers, federalism, and the rights of people. We believe that the people, not the government, are the best stewards of our country's God-given natural resources." Okay, it goes on with a great deal more. But look at the difference between the two-party platforms. America is an idea, a fluid thought, an emotion, a feeling, versus America is built on enduring principles, common purpose, American exceptionalism, the United States of America, a nation, okay, historic foundation, roots, and roles, the Declaration of Independence, our seminal documents, the Constitution, that it's not a flexible document, a feeling, or a fabrication. It is an enduring covenant, meaning it is immutable, it doesn't change. We believe in limited government, separation of powers, federalism, the rights of people. We believe that people are not, the government is not the source of our rights and privileges and freedoms, but God is our natural creator and giver of all. All right. Two differences. One platform is based on facts, immutable, unchangeable facts. America as a nation, America's historic role. History doesn't change. History is there. And the seminal documents are anchored in that history and in that exceptional, immutable, unchangeable fact of a nation with borders and laws and a constitution. I shouldn't have to say anything more. That in and of itself, the difference between these two platforms should be enough for you to say, well, I have to vote. I have to vote for the party that believes in facts rather than feelings, that America is a nation and not just a notion. I have to vote for something that, for leadership, that flawed though they or he may be, at least goes back to try to defend those self-evident truths and inalienable rights that are given by God and not just made up by the feelings of those who happen to attain government authority at a given time and in a given place. One of these platforms leads to despotism and tyranny and control. It's hierarchical. That's the Democrat platform. Top down, our feelings will govern all the rest of society because we'll tell you what to believe and who you are and what to think and how to live right now. The Democrats, because that's our feeling. It's our idea. America is an idea. The other platform says, no, America is a fact, and it's grounded in history, tradition, reason, and revelation. History, tradition, reason, and revelation. The quadrilateral. America is a fact. Which party do you think is going to guard your freedoms and guard your dignity? The one that's fluid or the one that's factual? Let's pause right now and recognize our sponsors, and I'll be right back in a couple minutes. I'm Dr. Everett Piper, and this is The Rebellion. Welcome back to The Rebellion. So with that as the context for the second half of the show, let's talk about Edmund Burke and his classic work, Reflections on the Revolution in France. Edmund Burke was born in 1729, okay? He enrolled in Trinity College in Oxford, and he was a young man. Even as a young man, he smelled the distant smoke of a coming catastrophe in Europe. He wrote, "We are on the verge of darkness. One push drives us in." He wrote that in 1746. So he wasn't even 20 years old yet when he had this prescient, prophetic view on what was going on in Great Britain as well as the European continent. He had a common theme in all of his work. Okay, his common theme in all of his work was the importance of not simplifying reality to fit an abstract theoretical scheme. In other words, he believed in facts, not feelings. He believed that when you tried to simplify the human experience to abstract theories, like postmoderns do and like progressives do, like the Democrats do, because that's what they are, he believed that it was better to ground your understanding of humanity and reality and all of the details and complexity of what it means to be a human being and of history. History. In other words, rather than theories of history, he preferred the facts of history. And he was motivated by an absolute hatred of oppression and the creation of laws that ignored historical traditions. Historical traditions. He was a fan of tradition. Not for the sake of traditions and not because he was unwilling to change, but because he recognized that the story of history needs to be respected and attended to because often the traditions have prevailed because of the lessons of time. He was the antithesis of chronological snobbery and the arrogance of youth. He believed in the wisdom of the ages. He was a critic of the Enlightenment arrogance and its disregard for time-tested truths. He felt it was the root of the tyranny that was rising in France. So the Enlightenment and its disregard for history and tradition and time-tested truths was going to lead to tyranny in France. He predicted that. Even as a young kid in his teens, he predicted that. Now, in his reflections on the revolution in France, he basically wrote a modern, the first modern conservative masterpiece. We still refer to it as that. He published that in 1790, by the way. He warned the whole world of the radicalism underlying the French Revolution, which took place in 1789, by the way. He said it was only a foretaste of the destruction to come, and he prophesied that the French Revolution would soon drench its own citizens in an orgy of blood. He was like Churchill. He understood very well that what happened in France wouldn't stay in France. It would spread to the entire world. So it was kind of like Churchill and his prescience when he saw that the Bolshevism, the communism, was a menace to the world. Churchill was saying that when everybody else was fawning over it as a solution to all of society's woes. And he also was smart enough to know that Nazis were barbarians and they shouldn't be appeased. So Burke was kind of a pre-Churchill. He was Churchillian in a way. So he defended tradition because he knew it was the repository of prudence and common sense and wisdom and truth. And he also understood the facts of human nature and human experience. He was like Aristotle, who believed that society is not based in an arbitrary social contract. Remember that language in the Democratic platform? A social contract. That's not accidental. They're going back to Rousseau. They're going back to Rousseau. Well, Aristotle disagreed with that. And Edmund Burke, likewise, played off of Aristotle and grounded his wisdom and reasoning, not only in Aristotle, but in the scriptures. He believed that society is not based on an arbitrary feeling or a social contract, but rather a contract that is concrete. A contract that is concrete and enduring. And enduring. One that's grounded in reality, self-evident truths, unalienable rights, endowed to us by God, not granted to us by groups or governments. This is what he said. This contract is a partnership. In all science, in all art, in every virtue, a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living and those who are dead, and those who are yet to be born. A clause in the great primeval contract of eternal society, connecting the visible and the invisible world, an inviolable oath which holds all physical and moral natures, each in their own appointed place. Now, is that good and strong language as opposed to this fluff and nonsense of America is just an idea? No, it's not just an idea. America is a nation that's grounded in the assumption that, yes, we do have a contract, and it is within the societal structure, but it's not made up by your feelings as they're fluid. No, America is a contract. It's a partnership in all the sciences, all the arts, every virtue. A partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living now, you and me, and those that preceded us, those that are dead. We honor our patriarchs because of the wisdom and the sacrifice they made to give us what we have right now. The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, one nation under God, indivisible, a nation with borders, with boundaries, and with laws, a real nation, not just an idea, a fact, not a fabrication. But he then goes on, and I think this is fascinating because it smacks of being prophetic of our time. He said, between those who are living, but also between those who are living and those that are dead and those yet to be born. Is this not a prophetic confrontation of abortion and the infanticide of the Democratic Party? That we have an obligation to honor not only those who preceded us in this contract, but those who are yet to come. That's our contract, because it's factual and it's grounded in the primeval contract of eternal society, God's society, connecting the visible and the invisible world, not just the material, but the spiritual, the higher world, not just the lower world, the inviolable oath which holds all physical and moral natures, each in their own appointed place. Now that is what a contract is, not a fluid social contract. Burke believed in a nation or a state or a people, and he believed that their particular things with their own history, their own laws, their own traditions, their own customs, their own manners, and their own morals. He held that the worst error that progressives make, the gnosis of the enlightened ones, the worst error that these progressives make is to damn all ancient institutions, manners, ideas, values, and customs because they found flaws in them. And they therefore go and uproot and destroy the old to build the new from scratch. He said this is a terrible error, and that's what they're doing in France. They throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's chronological snobbery to the max. It's the Jacobins. It's the French Revolution. It's the arrogance of youth. He called the French Revolution a philosophic revolution, an abstract revolution. Get it? Radicals such as Voltaire and Diderot sought to replace traditional wisdom and traditional society, the church, with an entirely new and untried and untested new society based on what they called reason. But it wasn't rational, logical, unchangeable reason. It was objective, subjective fluidity. It's their reason. It's not Aristotelian or Socratic reason. These people are hostile. They were hostile to religion, and specifically Christianity. They had secular self-assurance, and Christianity was the only obstacle they needed to overcome. Sound familiar? They believed that they, the smart ones, the intelligent few, as opposed to the unwashed masses, the rubes, the deplorables, those people in the hinterlands that lack gray matter, they believed that these select few, the elites, had unique possession of truth. This is his quote. The leaders of the legislative clubs, Government? And the coffee houses? Millennials sitting around in Starbucks? Are intoxicated with admiration at their own wisdom. They speak with the most sovereign contempt of the rest of the world. Does that paint a picture of AOC and Ilhan Omar and Rashid Tlaib and even the older ones like Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden? They have contempt for the rest of the world, for you and me. All they need to do is get rid of Christianity. It's the only obstacle. They are the smart ones. They're the intelligent few. And you, the unwashed masses, are nothing but rubes and deplorables. You need to be silenced. And one of the key things that these people always ignore, and I'm going to have to cut this short, maybe finish up tomorrow, but one of the things that they always ignore is the obvious, that the greatest problem, frankly the only problem that needs to be solved, is the greatest problem in man. And it's his wickedness, his sin. It isn't race, it isn't socioeconomics, it isn't poverty or wealth or education. It's human nature. And Edmund Burke understood this. He understood that the issue was sin, that it is a proven empirical part of history. Again, he goes back to history. He honors history and tradition and common sense and natural law. He honors the absolute, objective realities of what it means to be a human being in human history, rather than these fluid feelings and ideas. Here's his quote. In history, a great volume is unrolled for our instruction, drawing the wisdom from the past errors and the infirmities of mankind. History consists, for the great part, of the miseries brought upon the world by pride and ambition and avarice and revenge and lust and sedition and hypocrisy and all the train of disorderly appetites of man. In other words, he's saying that vice is a fact, and it's the most provable fact. It's not an idea. It's a fact, and it's spread throughout all people, male and female, black and white, rich and poor. Sin is the problem, and it's against this arrogance. It's against this fact, I should say, that the arrogance and the ignorance of the French Revolution unfolded and blood flowed in the streets. Remember this in November. Your freedom depends on it. Remember Edmund Burke, and you vote for a platform, not a person. You vote for a contract and a covenant, not a hierarchy. I'm Dr. Everett Piper. This is The Rebellion.